Good morning, brothers and sisters. It's really good to be with you this morning. We knew when we moved up here from South Carolina 2 years ago that there would be some sacrifice involved. One of the sacrifices that we took on was to become all things to all men, become Eagles fans. And so last night was kind of rough, wasn't it? Man, they're bad. Are you guys like in with Chip or are you out with Chip? Are you out? That's the general feeling I get. Amongst the city people. Well, we'll see what happens. Maybe he can get things turned around in the off season, like he didn't last year. So we'll see. We'll see what he's able to pull together. I want to thank you guys also for your location, because you give us a really convenient excuse to walk through IKEA yet another time. And so we do have plans right after this to go walk through IKEA. Isn't that going to be great? The world just celebrated a really incredible holiday that will only happen once ever. Does the date October 15th, 2015 mean anything to anybody in here? This is big. It's the day that Marty McFly travels into the future so that he can save his children yet to be born in Back to the Future's 1985. I don't know if you remember Back to the Future Day. It was just a few months ago in October. But there are a number of predictions that that the screenwriters, the scriptwriters made that oddly enough do, in fact, exist today. Like video conferencing, we've all done FaceTime or GoToMeeting, big screen TVs, hand-free video games, lots more that came true. And of course, there are a few that we haven't had the privilege of achieving success in yet, like the self-tying shoes. Do you remember those? Or everyone's favorite, the hoverboard? Still waiting on that one to come to fruition. And the Cubs still haven't broken the curse. In that movie, they predicted that in the year 2015, the Cubs would win the series. And they didn't. They were closer this year than they have been in a long time, but they still weren't able to pull through and even get to the series. And of course, the biggest piece of technology that the Doc and Marty got to enjoy still isn't available today. The flux capacitor empowered DeLorean time machine, right? Don't you wish that we could hop into that thing? Wouldn't that be sweet? It would be. Well, who says we can't pretend? We're going to pretend for a few minutes this morning. Imagine with me, if you will, walking out these doors and hopping into a time machine. It has to be a pretty big DeLorean for us all to fit in there. But we're going to type in 3 BC into the time machine's computer. So, you know, we ascend, and before you know it, you look down and you notice the expansive North Atlantic resting peacefully below us. And then moments later, you look down and you notice Stonehenge, which even in 3 BC is already a couple of thousand years old. London isn't going to be around for another 40 years still, so there's nothing even to see there. The machine moves quickly, and as you notice, as you look below the snowy Alps and the brown Italian landscapes below, soon you're crossing over the Adriatic Sea and begin to notice a sudden change in direction. You're going south. And as your machine glides slowly over another body of water, the Mediterranean Sea, you finally notice it's beginning to come to a rest. And it finally does land on the sun-cracked Palestinian soil. As you exit the aircraft, you're sure to get all of your items out of the overhead bins. And then your foot hits the soil. You look around you and you notice mud and brick houses all around you. And then there's a few mansions scattered about. And then in the distance, you can see the temple. And even beyond that, miles and miles of rolling hills. And as you continue to take these experiences in, you take a look over your shoulder and you notice that there's a shepherd sitting at the top of a hill, surrounded by a few dozen sheep. As you walk nearer to him to make contact with him, you notice that he has tear-streaked cheeks. And so you ask him, what's wrong? What's going on, buddy? He informs you that he has borrowed a copy of the book of Psalms. He had a wealthy friend that owned the book. He was too poor himself to own his own copy of Psalms, but he borrowed a copy of the book of Psalms from a wealthy friend. And he's been reading the Song of Ethan, the Song of Ethan, which for you and I would be Psalm 89. It's a psalm, a song that Ethan wrote. His heart has resonated with Ethan, the psalmist here, and he's lamenting with him. He's really discouraged, which is why you've seen the tears on his eyes. Well, what's he discouraged about? Let's take a brief step back from our time machine story here and hop in to Psalm 89. If you want to turn to Psalm 89 with me, we'll jump in there as our text for this morning. As you're turning there, there is a painful thread woven throughout this entire psalm. Our text this morning, Psalm 89, is a community lament. Part of its design, the reason Ethan wrote it, was to give the community of Israel a common voice to grieve over the yet unfulfilled promises that God had made to David. So Psalm 89 is a summary of another portion of the Bible written earlier than that, 2 Samuel 7. In 2 Samuel 7, God had promised David rest from his enemies, a dynasty of offspring and an unending succession to his throne. His throne was going to be established forever. No other family would ever occupy the throne other than David's family. Ethan, the author of this psalm, though, is looking around him at his circumstances and saying, look, the promises you made back then, they're not true. What's up, God? Is basically what he's saying in our modern vernacular. What is going on? This psalm is written out of grief, but it's more than just grief, though. It is written out of this really intense longing, a longing for God to make a mockery of his enemies and to plant his throne securely among his people, his chosen nation. But instead, Ethan looks around, and he doesn't see that. He sees verse 38 and 39. God has cast off and rejected his people. He is full of wrath against his anointed. He has renounced the covenant with David and defiled his crown in the dust. And this realization causes him to ask, if you look at verse 46, how long, O Lord, will you hide yourself forever? How long will your wrath burn like fire? Verse 49, Lord, where is your steadfast love of old, which by your faithfulness you swore to David? So Ethan is navigating some really angry waters of grief in his soul, and he doesn't know what to do with them. But he does have two anchors that hold him fast during this time of uncertainty and frustration. Two anchors that can hold us fast as well. Number one, God is faithful to keep his promises. God is faithful to keep all of his promises. Look with me, if you will, at verses 1 to 4. I will sing of the steadfast love of the Lord forever. With my mouth, I will make known your faithfulness to all generations. For I said, steadfast love will be built up forever. In the heavens, you will establish your faithfulness. You have said, I've made a covenant with my chosen one. I've sworn to David, my servant. I will establish your offspring forever and build your throne for all generations. So these first four verses here are a synopsis of what God promised to David, like we mentioned a few minutes ago in 2 Samuel 7. So Ethan is just recounting the promises that God has made already. The entire book of Psalms, and really the entire Bible, is a book about relationships. All throughout the scriptures, God is relating to his people by means of representatives. For instance, if you think ahead to Romans 5, it says this, for as by the one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners. So you got the one guy that's representing everybody, and because he sinned, everybody was named or made a sinner. And so by one man's obedience, the many will be made righteous. You got the flip side there, Jesus representing those who would be righteous. So Adam is our representative, through his disobedience makes us sinners. And then Jesus, the second Adam, representative of all his people, through his obedience makes us righteous. They speak and act, representatives do, they speak and act on our behalf. Sometimes we see this in our government with our representatives, and sometimes we don't. Depending on the representative, they may or may not speak and act on our behalf. But something similar is happening here in Psalm 89 in 2 Samuel 7. God is blessing David, but as king of God's people, David represented God's people. And so the blessings and curses that are rained down on David were also rained down on the people that he represented as the king of those people. When the people of God heard and saw that God had promised blessing to David, they rejoiced because they knew that blessing was coming to them as well, because David was a representative of them. So they would receive the same blessing through the mediating influence of David. So here we find Ethan in the first four verses here rejoicing because of a promise God had made to David. But like we mentioned at the beginning, at the outset, this rejoicing is about to be clouded over by a really miserable gloom. But even in the circumstances that seem to mock and scoff the promises of God, Ethan looks around him and says, "This is not what's happening. You say this here, but I look around me, and what you say doesn't match up with what I see." Even in the midst of this, Ethan remains confident in his faithful God. So to him, the circumstances appeared absolutely hopeless. There was no king on the throne like God had promised. There was no unending succession of David's offspring. God's word had gone unfulfilled. It caused him to question God. "God, why? How long? Won't you please act to preserve your honor among the nations? They're laughing at us." Do you think it's wrong to question God? Is it wrong in your heart to question him? Which of us can't sympathize with Ethan, right? We look around at our circumstances, all that's going on in the world around us, whether it's in your personal life, in the Southeast with the tornadoes, or with ISIS, or with whatever the case may be, you fill in the blank. Which of us haven't asked, like, what's going on? God, step in, act. What would it have meant, though, if Ethan didn't have any questions for God? Might it have meant that he had a comfort level with what was going on around him? Could it have meant that there was no ache in his soul for the fame and the glory of God to be made manifest among his people and the planet? I think we can question God at times, not because we lack faith in his goodness, but because we have faith in his goodness. Our questioning can be that of reverent prayer. Our questioning can be a fleeing to God. This is a casting of our care on him because we know he cares for us. Now, this hasn't happened to me before, but I imagine it could. I have three little girls, a five-year-old, a four-year-old, and a one-year-old. We have a child on the way, and there's no chance that it's going to be a boy because it just doesn't happen to me. But we're excited to have our fourth little girl. We don't know yet, but I know it's a girl. So we're going to have four little girls. And again, this hasn't happened to me, but I imagine it could. So we're at a July 4th celebration, and the sky is lighting up very brightly with the fireworks, and the sound is deafening and booming. And for a little three-year-old, it can be disconcerting and frightening. And so I can imagine her coming up to me and just grabbing onto my leg and kind of looking up. Is it okay, Daddy? Are we going to be safe? Of course, I know that I'm here to guarantee her safety, her joy, her delight in this time. Because after all, these fireworks are meant to delight us. But how disconcerting for me would it be if when she saw all these scary things, she ran away? It would be very disheartening as a parent in the midst of a time when she has questions in her heart about her safety and about her welfare, if she ran away from me. No, I want her to flee to me with her questions, not away. I want her to check with me to make sure everything is under control. "Am I going to be safe, Daddy?" And of course, I would look at her and say, "Yeah, I got you. It's going to be safe." It's an indication, not that she distrusts me when she comes to me and asks me that. It's an indication that she, in fact, does trust me. In texts like this, God is saying, "Trust me." Just because you don't understand your circumstances, because you don't understand what you see around you, because it doesn't match up with what you think reality should look like, just because you don't understand doesn't mean they're not for your good. Trust me, I have a track record. I have a long record of doing the right thing at the right time. if you're not questioning God? Could it be that you have such a comfort with the world, the broken world that you live in? Does your heart ever ache over frustration, over sin in your heart or in others? Maybe your non-questioning of God could mean that you have a real comfort level. No ache in your soul for the glory of God to be made known in your house and in your on your block and in your neighborhood and in this city and in the world. Are you too comfortable? Of course, the circumstance wasn't hopeless. And Ethan, he knew this. God had promised something big. And his promises, Ethan knew, and we know, are unshakable. They're unshakable. How about you? Does your situation seem really hopeless right now? Are you going through something that is just overbearing and you feel like you almost can't stand? There's an elephant on your back. I don't want you to think that the scriptures can't feel what you're feeling, how difficult it is. This is why we have a book like the Psalms, because it gives us as humans expression on both ends of the spectrum, a broad breadth of emotions. The psalmists experience a wide breadth of emotions too. 1 minute they're dancing with the planets, and the next they're wallowing in the grave and just in suffering and depression. Understand that the fear and frustration and hopelessness you might have right now about whatever it is isn't always a bad thing, as long as they're driving you to a confident assurance in the unrelenting faithfulness of God. Of course, we're broken. We are not whole, but God is. And our broken situation should be pointing us to the God who puts all things back together. God is faithful to maintain his promises. His faithfulness is relentless. It goes on and on and on and on and never stops. There's no way God won't be faithful to keep his promises to you in Jesus. Do you believe him? This psalm, if understood properly, is meant to catapult our faith up into the stratosphere. And I'm going to show us why here in just a second. There's a reason why this psalm is written, and it's meant to make our faith even more sturdy, because God comes through on what he says he's going to do. And we're going to talk about that in just a second. So the first anchor is that God is faithful to keep his promises. And the second is that God is powerful to keep his promises. Look, we've already done the whole first anchor. We're halfway through. Isn't that great? Anchor number two, God is powerful to keep his promises. The other anchor that holds Ethan fast is God's power. He's not only faithful, he has the strength to come through in the way that he says he's going to come through. Sometimes I look at my kids and I wonder if my thoughts toward them are the same thoughts that God as our Father has towards us. When my oldest Eden was younger, she struggled at night with fearfulness. And so she would, we'd put her to bed, but she would want a light on in her room. I'm sure many of you experienced this. Maybe you're an adult and you still want this. You want a light on, and she wanted a light on in her room. And then in the hallway. And then she wanted me to stay upstairs with her. And then she wanted me to stay in the room with her. And then possibly, if she was really lucky, in the bed with her, right? She was just fearful. She wanted my presence to be known. And she wanted to feel that presence. And I just wanted to shake her during those times and say, look, baby, relax, right? This is my house. This is my house. I own it. No one's going to get you. I got your back, right? I'm here for you. And so I wonder if sometimes God's thoughts about us are the same. All throughout verses 5 to 18, the psalmist here is reminding himself of these kinds of facts concerning his relationship with God. Verse 11, the heavens are yours. The earth also is yours. The world and all that is in it, you have founded them. Skip to verse 13. You have a mighty arm. Strong is your hand. High your right hand. This passage speaks for God and says, look, guys, I got this. It's my world. Relax. Kings and kingdoms and presidents, they all pass away. But I don't and I won't pass away. My steadfast love endures forever. No angel compares to this God. He rules the sea. He crushes his foes. He owns the heavens. He owns the earth. He owns the galaxies, and he is exalted above the Most High. He's the ruler of all, and he is worthy of our praise. Your body today might be aching. Your soul might be bleeding. Your heart might be very fearful. The world around you is dying, but God is not dead. He's alive, and he's powerful to keep all of his promises. But this text is more than just comfort for physical and spiritual ailments. As tears were rolling down his cheeks, Ethan, the author of this psalm, little did he know that the dreadful clouds of God's providence were about to burst open with mercy and break with blessings on the heads of God's people. This text propels us forward to Christ, where the fulfillment will utterly explode all of our expectations. This is how we can fully and finally know that God is faithful to keep his promises and that he is powerful to keep his promises, because Christ has come. Christ came. He came through evidencing that what God says, he will do. Hope has come into the world in the form of this baby boy that we just celebrated. If we could hop back into our time machine just for a second and punch in 68 AD. So we're like 70, 75 years later. We'll land in the same spot we landed before. We'll step out and we'll see a similar landscape. Look back over your shoulder and you'll see a shepherd sitting at the top of a hill, surrounded by a few dozen other sheep, probably, because I don't think they last that long. But it's the same shepherd. Same shepherd. He's about 80 years old now. It's been about 5 seconds for us and 80 years for him, right? We all know how the time travel thing works. But he's still faithfully caring for his sheep. He sees you and immediately remembers you were the first time traveler he had ever met before. You're supposed to laugh there. It's supposed to be funny. So thank you. Before you guys can finish shaking hands and reacquainting, he's unraveling this crazy story about a host of angels in the sky, the birth of a king, and the fulfillment of a promise made thousands of years before it came true. For an 80-year-old, this dude is excited. I mean, the brother is joyful. He's got a fresh copy of the epistle to the Hebrews that he's reading. Now, if you're new to the Christian faith, the psalm that we've been working from this morning was written before Jesus came. It's a prophetic psalm. But the epistle to the Hebrews, that in our just make-believe story that we're telling right here with time machines and everything, I hope you realize that, right? This isn't in the Bible. There's no time machines in the Bible. So the epistle to the Hebrews that our shepherd on the hill that doesn't exist is reading, was written after Christ. And so he's been reading this book called Hebrews. And he eagerly reads aloud to you the first few verses, and then he stops to emphasize verse 5, which just happens to be a synopsis of the first of two verses, not the first two, but of two verses in Psalm 89, which, if you remember, is also a synopsis of 2 Samuel 7. So lots of synopsi here. Here in Hebrews chapter 1, verse 5, here God says of Jesus, he says, "You are my son. I will be to you a father, and you shall be to me a son." God became the father of David's son. But clearly, according to this book of Hebrews, this is not a reference to Solomon, which we might all expect after reading Psalm 89. We might think, oh yeah, Psalm 89 is just referring to David's son, Solomon. But the writer of Hebrews didn't understand it that way. Clearly, the writer of Hebrews identifies Christ as the fulfillment of these promises to David. Psalm 89 is ultimately about Jesus. Surely many thought that Solomon was the final fulfillment. And of course, we know how that turned out. The kingdom was divided, and eventually the throne was lost completely, shattering or seemingly shattering all the promises that God had made to David. But my, how things have changed now for this shepherd who's reading the book of Hebrews. Instead of looking for the physical fulfillment in Psalm 89, the shepherd understands the spiritual nature of the fulfillment of this psalm and others. By the end of this conversation, you realize that his understanding of Psalm 89 has radically been altered. What used to be a lament has now become a longing fulfilled. Something has come true that wasn't true yet. Christ has come, and he has proved God's faithfulness and his power to do what he says he's going to do. So just a couple of concluding observations here on Psalm 89. When I was in elementary school, the magic eye phenomenon was spreading like wildfire. Do you guys remember these? For me, it was probably early to mid-90s. And these strange patterns that are on a page, it's usually like a glossy page, do something funky with your depth perception, and somehow they give this illusion of a 3D image. Do you remember these? Yeah. Theoretically, the longer you stare at one of these magic eye images, the more clear the 3D image becomes. At the start, it seems as if you're staring like at a conglomeration of colors and markings and squiggles and lines. But after staring, and sometimes prolonged staring, a 3D image begins to appear. You might see a house or a shark or a smiley face or something like that. It's quite remarkable, really. As a child, I had extreme difficulty finding these images. And I remember a distinct time. My dad is actually here today. They flew up from Atlanta to spend a week for us. And I remember a distinct time, he probably won't remember this, sitting in our living room. And we had one of these books out. And he would ask me, "Josh, do you see it?" I said, "No, Dad, I don't see it." "Well, now do you see it?" "No, I don't see it. I struggled to find these images." I am happy and thrilled and very proud to say that I've overcome my inability to see these images now. Nevertheless, you understand. It was frustrating then, but having overcome it now, I'm blessed to see the 3D images. We need to read our Bibles with the patience it takes to discover its own subtle 3D images. And I'm not talking about actual images. Maybe at first glance, it will seem a bit mundane as you read your Bible. The simple strokes that make up the words on the page might just seem to present ancient fact, mere ancient fact. But I think as we stare deeply into it, we'll begin to discover a really clear 3D image appearing. As we stare deeply into the truths of Scripture and we digest them, we'll see a glorious 3D image of King Jesus appearing. He makes it all make sense and tie it together. And so, as we stare into the Scriptures and read the Old Testament, especially the Old Testament, so like Psalm 89 today is in the Old Testament, as we read the Old Testament through New Testament lenses, so if we put on our New Testament glasses, knowing that Jesus has come, and we look back into the Old Testament, it will allow us to watch these seemingly random accounts in the Old Testament take shape. And the random shapes and colors of the Old Testament morph into the glorious image of the New Testament, where we see Christ has come to pay for our sins. Now, the Bible isn't like a magic hat, like a magician would use to pull a rabbit out of it. We don't open up a text and say, poof, there's Jesus. There's a respectable and responsible way to do this. But this book right here is in all aspects an exposition of Jesus Christ. Everything before Jesus points to him. Everything after Jesus points back to him. It's all about Jesus. Every covenant, every feast, every person, prophet, battle, betrayal, every king's reign, every talking donkey, every prophet's vision, every law spoken, every disciple's miracle, everything is about Jesus. And we need to read our Bibles like this. It's all a part of a grand drama that reveals how God is saving his undeserving people through a glorious Lamb. Read all of the Scriptures in light of Christ. That's one thing we can learn from Psalm 89, especially when we see echoes of it in the New Testament. We understand that it was written for a purpose, to speak ahead, to whisper about the Christ that was coming. Also, just take a note at this Psalm's order. I think it's instructive for us. The psalmist starts by verifying what is true in verses 1 through 4, and then he moves on to what he can see, the things that are alarming to him and frustrating to him. We must progress in that same order. We can't ever switch this. We must start with what we know is true and allow that to interpret what we see around us. We can't let what we see around us interpret what we see in his book. We can't switch that order. Always allow what you know to be true to interpret what you see. This psalm ends on an unresolved chord. Circumstances didn't change for Ethan at the end of it. Life was still hard. He probably cried the next day. It's kind of like singing, "Joy to the world, the Lord is come." Like, you may not have liked the first part, but the end part was even worse than the first part, right? I didn't sing the right note at the end. It's frustrating for us as humans to not hear a resolving note at the end of a line or of a song. At the end of this psalm, it doesn't really resolve. It doesn't quite sit right with us. God doesn't sweep in and make everything joyous and okay. But the unsettled tension of that chord is fully and finally resolved. The right note comes in the coming of Christ that we just celebrated. When we realize that God will resolve all tension in the end, we can rest. And as you do this, we can echo Ethan at the end of this psalm, the very last verse. Despite our circumstances, we can confidently shout, "Blessed be the Lord forever." Amen. The Lord of this covenant will not be thwarted in his intention to bring sinners out of the realm of darkness into his gracious domain of light. In 2 Samuel 7, David vowed to build God a house. I don't know if you remember David's promise, but he said, "I want to build you a house, God." And maybe you remember that David was denied that privilege for various reasons that we won't get into today. But instead, here's what God did. He flipped the script. He said, "David, I'm going to build you a house, a forever house, not a house made of cedar, of wood, but a house made of people, a family who will last forever. This is the house right here that God is building for David." You and I are part of God's fulfilled promise. Isn't that cool? We are a fulfillment of something that was spoken and written thousands of years ago. How glorious. God was and is actively creating a house with living stones. You and I as the living stones. We are the fulfillment of a text thousands of years old. Awesome. Since Jesus is the cornerstone of the church, the foundation that will never fail, it's established forever. This house isn't going anywhere. Jesus is the better David. He's going to make it last forever. Concluding here. So how much more should you and I, on this side of Jesus, be able to sing of the mercies of the Lord forever? Because of God's covenant, we can sing this song, and we can sing it forever. God is relentlessly pursuing his unstoppable mission, and he's not going to fail. This text is about trusting and resting when the waves of life keep crashing in, and you don't feel like you can get your nose above water, and you're having a hard time breathing. Trust in the faithfulness and the power of God. We as New Testament believers have great reason to trust in the faithfulness and power of God during these times. We can trust because Christ came and God does what he says he's going to do. Because the promise to Adam and Eve and to Abraham and his offspring, to David and his offspring, they've all been fulfilled by Christ. Maybe you're here today and you don't particularly believe the truth of the Christian Bible. This may all sound a little strange and maybe even a little suspicious to you. Prophecies made thousands of years before their fulfillment and actually coming true? Psh, no way. No way. Let me assure you that this is the best news that anyone could ever hear. God created us, and so he has rights over us. Maybe many of you in here own a house. When you own a house, You can paint the walls whatever color you want to. You have hair on your head. I'm getting less and less hair on my head, but you have hair on your head, and in some sense, you own it. You can dye it whatever color you want, right? Creators are owners, and as our creator, God has ownership over us, and so he gets to determine what it takes to get into his home, into heaven. And so what he has said is that there is one way, and Jesus said it. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one gets to the Father except through me, Jesus says. Not by works of righteousness, which we can do, but according to your mercy. For by grace, we're saved through faith. Not of ourselves. It's a gift of God. You can't do it. And God has determined that the way to him is through King Jesus. So God created us and he has rights over us. But we have sinned against God time and time again. God could have left us in this helpless state. He doesn't have to let us back in. But he didn't do that. He sent Jesus. This Jesus, who came as a form in the form of a baby, lived perfectly in our place, lived the life we couldn't live. And then he died the death that I and you deserve to die. He died in our place, and now he lives again. So I would plead with you to accept the Bible's claims of Jesus by faith. Submit to him as your king. He's a good king, a gracious king. And be saved. He's faithful and he's powerful to keep his promises. How do we know this? Because Jesus came. Today, if you're not trusting in this Jesus, you are under the law. This is what God says, not me. You're under the law and you're an enemy of God. Please realize that you're accountable to God and therefore you are guilty. You need something to get you to God. You need someone. And you need Jesus. He's faithful and he's powerful. Will you trust him today? If you have any questions about what I've said today, especially if this is all new to you, please feel free to chat with me afterward. I'd love to speak with you about it in just a moment here. When Christ entered this world in the humble, helpless state of a child, God was making a statement. In the quietness of that stable, God was shouting, I'm steadfastly loving. Remember those promises I made long ago? They've been fulfilled. Trust me, I will not fail to follow through on the promises that I have made. Christ is the fulfillment of the promise to David in Psalm 89. Our only proper response is loud singing and steadfast confidence in the unfailing mission of God. He's faithful and he's powerful, so trust him. God, thank you for sending Jesus, for giving us a way back to you. We couldn't make our way to you. We are dead in our transgressions and sins. But you can make us alive. And so I pray that if anyone here today needs to be made alive, that you would do that, that you would show them the truth, the gracious truth that is King Jesus, come for us, dying for us, and living now above for us. Please continue to help us trust in your faithfulness, in your power to keep your promises. For the glory of the King, amen.